garlic and steaks and things. And even though I cannot die, I do not enjoy having a tent peg put in my ribs. I've had it before, and I do not want it again. If I can promise you real doctors and a clean hospital bed, no stakes, no shouting, will you be still and let me do my work? He laughs at me, says, all right, and I tell Dominic to walk back to the field hospital and have them bring the car out with a stretcher. Dominic is very nervous at the idea of my staying in the church with a vampire, but he agrees to do it.
David Horovitch and Hattie Morahan continue to read The Tiger's Wife by Thea Obrecht at the same time tomorrow. The abridger was Sally Marmion and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. Now join Carmarthen comedian Ellis James tonight as he scours the land of his fathers as part of an attempt to establish a pantheon of Welsh national icons, and where the opening theme of seafarers includes both man and, somewhat surprisingly, beast.
Now, of course, the ultimate Welsh hero doesn't necessarily need to be a human. It can be a dog. Swansea Jack was a black retriever, and when he died at the age of 7 in 1937, that's 49 in dog years, he had pulled 27 people out of the sea. I should clarify, they were in trouble. He wasn't just a dog who enjoyed ruining seaside holidays.
Hear which men, women, as well as possibly dogs of Harlech will make the grade in Ellis James's Pantheon of Heroes, new to 4 Extra, starting tonight at 11 in the Comedy Club.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
And now we're back on the trail of The Lost Mona Lisa by R.A. Scotti, the true story about the mysterious theft of the famous Leonardo da Vinci painting from the Louvre in 1911. And in part two, the hunt is on for the thief and the missing painting. It's read by Nicholas Grace.
When Mona Lisa slipped out of her frames, she seemed to change from a missing masterpiece to a missing person. The public felt her loss as emotionally as an abduction or a kidnapping. Crowds gathered outside the Louvre, awaiting word from the prison-like fortress that had failed to keep her safe. The police had the frames, a fingerprint, date, and approximate time of the theft, and a possible accomplice in the plumber, Sauve. But they still had no idea how Mona Lisa had left the Louvre. She was not a canvas that could be rolled up and sneaked out. Leonardo had painted her on a solid panel of white Lombardy poplar, 21 by 31 inches. She would be difficult to conceal even without her frames. Yet every exit guard insisted that she had not gone through his door. Was the painting still on the premises? The Louvre is the largest museum in the world, covering some 49 acres. Searching it consumed an army of inspectors and gendarmes. They combed even the vast underground vaults, fashioned from the caves of the ancient wolf hunters who gave the Louvre its name. Loup vivre, where wolves live. Prefect of the Seine, Lépine, vowed that if Mona Lisa were lost in the Louvre, his men would find her. Privately, he believed she was long gone, that a ring of art thieves was behind the abduction. The operation was too slick to be the work of a lovesick psychotic, a common crook, or any gang of amateurs. And it was too difficult for a single thief. Tips began to pour in from all parts of Europe. In London, a seedy-looking foreigner with a black moustache waxed at the tips had appeared without an appointment at the Bond Street showroom of Duveen Brothers, carrying all his worldly goods in a small to medium-sized white wooden case. "I have the Gioconda here in London. Will you buy it?" The French call her La Joconde. European art dealers were earning their fortunes by building collections for American tycoons, and none were more successful than the Duveens. But they wanted no part in such a sensational, highly publicized affair as the Mona Lisa heist. The stranger, dismissed rudely, crossed the Channel again and made his way from Calais to northern Italy, where the American millionaire collector, J. Pierpont Morgan, was on vacation. Sharks at home. The Americans were innocents abroad, targets for every kind of scam. And though J.P. Morgan was an astute collector, even he suffered an occasional fleecing. He was once persuaded to put a down payment on the bronze doors of Bologna's Duomo di San Pietro, which has no bronze doors. Morgan was in Italy when Mona Lisa disappeared. The press pursued him more relentlessly than the police were pursuing any other suspect. He resented the intimations that he would traffic in stolen goods and rebuffed the reporters, insisting that had he been offered the Mona Lisa, he should have bought it and given it back to France. On Monday, the 28th of August, the search of the Louvre was complete, but nothing more was found. The plumber, Sauve, had been sweating through piles of mugshots trying to find the face of the man on the stairs. The criminologist, Alphonse Bertillon, had been comparing the fingerprints of more than 200 Louvre employees. But no match was found. A week after locking its doors, the Louvre prepared to reopen and expose the naked area to the public. Queues stretched for blocks to view the blank space on the gallery wall. Mona Lisa's theft has been called the perfect crime of the modernist era, because it seemed to mirror the nihilism that would preoccupy the new century. Thousands stood and gazed at nothingness, absorbing absence. In a way, it should have been a triumph for the young Turks of the new art. Instead, it was almost their downfall. On the day the museum reopened, a canary began to sing. He did not chirp softly into the ear of Prefect Lépine, but sang loudly and publicly to the editors of the Paris Journal. It was not a random choice. Its arts editor, André Salmon, was a friend of the informer. The front page was devoted to a startling confession. A thief brings us a statue stolen from the Louvre. The thief was identified as a young man, aged somewhere between 20 and 25, very well mannered, with a certain American chic, whose face and look and behaviour bespoke at once a kind heart and a certain lack of scruples. In exchange for 250 francs, the thief sold the Journal a small statue he had filched from the museum. His full confession was played on page one. In March 1907, he picked up the head of a woman, concealed it under his vest, and walked out. He sold the statue to a Parisian painter friend for 50 francs, which he lost the same night in a billiard parlour. The next day, he took a man's head with enormous ears. Then, he emigrated. On his return in May of 1911, he took the head of a woman that he stuffed in his trousers. "And now one of my colleagues has spoiled all my plans by making this hullabaloo in the painting department." The next day, the Paris Journal reported a second encounter with the thief, who handed a sheet of paper for the editor-in-chief, on which he had written a protest. "Bourgeois society, which makes life so hard for anyone without funds, whatever his intellectual qualities, is responsible for these wanderings from the straight and the narrow." The note was signed, Baron Ignace d'Ormaison. Prefect Lépine believed that the same ring of international art thieves was behind both Louvre thefts, L'affaire des statuettes and L'affaire de la Joconde. On the 2nd of September, the arts editor of the Paris Journal, André Salmon, spent the morning closeted in his office with detectives from the Paris Prefecture who were demanding information on Baron d'Ormaison. Salmon's rebuff was courteous and couched with sincere regrets. He was bound by professional ethics not to reveal his sources. Although criminal records turned up no information on the Baron, the name Baron Ignace d'Ormaison was familiar to the Parisian literati as a fictional character in Les Résiarques et Cie, a collection of stories nominated for the country's most prestigious literary award, Le Prix de Goncourt. The police were soon knocking on the apartment door of the Baron's very real, very voluble creator, Guillaume Apollinaire. In the 7 years from 1905 to 1911, the genesis story of modern art was being written. Pablo Picasso was its genius. Guillaume Apollinaire was its impresario. Urging the destruction of all museums because they paralyze the imagination, Apollinaire championed Picasso as a young god who wants to remake the world. Mona Lisa was the archetype of the dead masterpieces they were rejecting. Apollinaire was one of the most public and popular members of the artistic community of Paris. He and Picasso were friends and leaders of a group loosely known as La Bande de Picasso. Young, brilliant, and ruthlessly ambitious. At Picasso's apartment, buried in the back of a cupboard within easy reach, were two figures. A small, powerfully built stone man with an enormous ear, and a woman carved by the ancient Spaniards during the Bronze Age, the bottom of each bearing the stamp, Property of the Musée du Louvre. On the 5th of September, increasingly alarmed at the Baron's confessions, one or other of them brought the incriminating evidence to the Paris Journal. On the 6th of September, the story of the two new restitutions made page one. On the 7th of September, Apollinaire was under arrest. Aghast at the prospect of imprisonment, he reluctantly identified the Louvre thief, Baron Ignace d'Ormaison, as a Belgian in his early 30s, called Géry. Géry had been living in Apollinaire's apartment and working for him as a secretary of sorts. For the blithely amoral Géry, stealing artifacts from the Louvre was a lark, and incriminating the Picasso gang was another. Once he revealed Géry's identity, Apollinaire expected to be freed. Instead, he was taken to La Santé prison. The circumstantial evidence against him was damning. Mona Lisa and Géry had disappeared on the same day. She from the Louvre, he from Apollinaire's apartment. It only remained for Apollinaire to identify his accomplices, particularly the painter who had brought the stolen statues. Apollinaire gave his interrogators the name they wanted. Picasso. Insisting Picasso had been taken advantage of and never knew the antiquities came from the Louvre. 19 days after Mona Lisa disappeared, the police paid a visit to Picasso's apartment. If the detective had searched Picasso's studio, he would have found the incriminating evidence in the painting. He wanted to use the statues in his new, large, disturbing brothel scene, Les Demoiselles d'Avignon. Picasso was taken by bus to the Palais de Justice, no police vehicle being available. At 11 o'clock, Apollinaire arrived at the courthouse. At 3 o'clock, a guard led him handcuffed to the courtroom to be arraigned with his accomplice. As the door opened, he was swept up in a surge of reporters and photographers. Exactly what transpired in that courtroom depends on who is telling the story. Painter and poet were so nervous that in their desperation to assert their own innocence, they contradicted themselves and one another. Both men wept and begged for forgiveness and freedom, and with nothing to substantiate them as the gang of international thieves, they were released. The charges against Apollinaire not being dismissed until January 1914. L'affaire des statuettes may have started as a practical joke instigated by André Salmon with Géry's feckless collusion. It was a huge coup for the Paris Journal, the paper printing more copies than ever before. Sarmon probably intended the confessions to be amusing, and they were. But if he instigated the hoax, he misjudged the mood of Paris and the magnitude of the Mona Lisa theft. Above all, he misjudged the depth of shame he would bring on his friends. As for Géry, he turned up the next year in Cairo, where he was arrested and eventually acquitted. For years, Picasso never spoke of Apollinaire and the Mona Lisa arrest. He continued becoming Picasso, the most extraordinary, the wealthiest, and ironically, the most stolen artist of the 20th century. The Apollinaire-Picasso spectacle had been a diversion. The investigation stumbled on. Mona Lisa became the phantom of the Louvre.
And tomorrow, as the hunt for the missing painting continues, just why has Leonardo da Vinci's painting beguiled people through the ages? Nicholas Grace was reading part two of The Lost Mona Lisa by R.A. Scotti. It was produced by Duncan Minchell.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello, Joanna Pinnock here at 3 o'clock. Drama now with our epic tale of love and a modern retelling of an Indian classic. Stay with us for the final part of the Ramayana. And later, Now You See Her, Now You Don't. Mel will be looking at the science behind invisibility in today's 4 o'clock show. Victoria Pendleton talks about training to become an Olympic athlete. And Fred McCauley will be keeping it in the family. That's all in an hour. But now we continue our modern version of an ancient Indian epic and one of the world's most enduring love stories, the Ramayana, dramatised by Anne Bellone. Sita has been abducted by a ruthless warlord. Rama enlists the help of an army of monkeys to get her back, but has she already betrayed him?
Your bright colours and that irritating voice.
Leave the bird alone.
It must have seen something. Tell me, daughter.
Let it go.
It was about to speak.
The parrot doesn't know where Sita is.
Then who does? The bees, the elephants, the lions on the other side of this forest?
Jatayu said...
Jatayu is dead. Our vulture friend was no help to us.
At least we know Ravan has her.
But where did he take her? He's got bolt holes all over the country. She could be anywhere. What use of Jatayu if he can't...
He tried to fight Ravan. He died trying to help Sita.
These animals are useless. The mango trees, the champa, the jackfruit.
Please?
Be patient.
Please? Would you young men know where I can get some water?
There's a spring nearby. Just follow the path to your right.
Bless you, my son.
Ask the sadhu.
No. Could be another trick.
Then I will.
Rama?
Swami, wait!
Yes?
I don't need blessings.
You need good fortune.
Stop. Sorry, Baba. Who are you?
Who's asking?
Oh, forgive my friend. He's not well.
I'm the elder son of Dasharath.
See? Why would a prince be wandering in the forest dressed in these rags? He's delusional.
I'm Rama, and this is my brother Lakshman.
My lord!
The old sadhu falls at Rama's feet to pay his respect.
Please, get up. I don't need you to kiss my feet. I need help.
The sadhu moans as if in pain. He rises up, slowly, bending and buckling.
Well, what's wrong with him?
Stand back. Stay out of his way.
Fur starts appearing on his hands and feet. The sadhu's lungi drops away. He throws his head back and roars. Towering a foot above us, the fur spreads over his body in an instant. The old man's bald head is no longer human. The face of a monkey stares at us, and a tail sprouts from his backside.
What are you, monkey?
I'm your ally. What are you doing in this forest? Are you a demon?
We saw you from our settlement. Sir Greaver, the Monkey Lord, sent me to find out if you were Bali's spies.
Who's Bali?
A traitor who plotted against my lord. Forgive me for not recognizing you. Please come with me to our hideout. Sir Greaver will give you whatever you want.
I want to find my wife. She's been stolen from me, taken by General Ravan's army.
Hanuman. My name's Hanuman. I'll find her for you.
We trek through the forest for some hours. Rama tells Hanuman how we found Jatayu near dead on the forest floor, how Ravan had torn at the vulture's wings like a crazed dog. Rama asks every plant, every flower, each snake, each ant he comes across, if they know where Sita is. He's quite mad, and my throat gets drier and drier. I'm happy to reach Kishkinda, the Monkey Kingdom, and desperate for a bowl of food. But we wait. We have to wait until Sugriva, the Monkey King, will see us.
Eat! Eat!